the end of order. What we're going to be dealing with is kind of jumping right back into part of our study from yesterday, but we're going to also look at it from a slightly different standpoint. I'm going to go back into Daniel and look at Daniel's visions. And we're going to see sort of the prophetic view of the wind down, and then we're going to go back and take a look through some of the volumes and also through some other accounts that we found in various books, similar to what the pastor did in the fourth volume, only some updated versions of the view of the wind down of the Gentile systems. And we're going to really be able to see through that just how severe that breakup of the old order was. First of all, we're going to take a look at it from the proper prophetic view. So we're going to go look at Daniel 7. And the 2nd through 7th verse initially. And Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision that night, and behold, the four winds of heaven strove upon the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion, and had an eagle's wings, and beheld its wings, and I beheld it till its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made to stand upon its feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And of course, this first one is a picture of the Empire of Babylon. Fifth verse. And behold, another beast, a second like a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it between its teeth. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. And of course, this would be Medo-Persia. Verse 6, And after this, behold, I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon its back four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it, and this one being Greece. And finally, the fourth empire, verse 7. And after this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue in its feet, and was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And we're going to go on in a minute. You find then that the common denominator behind these is that as we progress beast to beast, the beasts get more terrible. And of course, each one of these are representing beastly governments, and probably by the end of the day you're going to be so sick of beasts, because we're going to be doing that again in Revelation 12 and 13, that it's going to seem like we have a zoo around here. And I guess that's probably an apt way of looking at the world and its conditions down through 2,520 years. It really was a zoo. We find then, moving on to verse 8, a little bit more consideration of this fourth beast. And I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another, a little horn, before which there were three of the first horns plucked out by the roots. And behold, in this horn were the eyes, like the eyes of man, and a mouth, speaking great things. Now, as we mentioned before, this, of course, was the Roman Empire. And we notice that the Roman Empire had a beginning as a civil system and eventually grew into a papacy. So the 10 initial horns that we see here are the divisions of its power, civil divisions of its power. And the little horn then that comes up is the beginnings of papacy. So we see that the fourth beast was pagan first and finally papal. And it was one of the things that we see about this is that it was characteristic of Satan's ability, because we see it was transformed supposedly from this beastly appearance into a beautiful religious organization. And along with that, we would cite 2 Corinthians 11:14, its ability to transform itself, for Satan to transform, to appear as an angel of light, and sort of remove this supposed ugliness. We notice that three of the original 10 horns were plucked up to make way for this small one, which was coming up. And those three represented the Herulai, the Eastern Exarchaic, and the Ostrogoths. Now we also notice that this horn is not really looking at it from the standpoint of an ecclesiastical system, but that the papal power and its establishment was being made as a civil power or horn. And we'd cite you to first volume, page 258, or A258. Now we also notice that this particular horn, conspicuous not only by its size, but also by the fact that this one had eyes and a mouth. And so the eyes were indicative of its supposed intelligence. And of course the intelligence was along a more worldly standpoint. And also we might suggest along with that its ability to kind of see all its opposers or adversaries. And secondly, a mouth that uttered great claims and great utterances. And we aren't going to go into that too much because that's going to get picked up this afternoon. But the one thing that we find is that this was so terrible a system that there really was no particular name that could come up for it. But we find a name being given, again, as we're going to cover this afternoon in Revelation 12:9, referring to it as the devil. So, completely linked then with Satan, totally intermeshed. We find judgment was to be rendered against the beast, and that was gradually consumed. But as opposed to some of these other beasts, we find this one was consumed by the horn first. And so the pastor points out to us that this horn was consumed between the dates of 1799 and 1870. And we reference here page A259 and C68. Now, of course, these two dates are rather conspicuous. 1799 being the date at which the Pope, currently in power, was imprisoned by Napoleon, taken away from his seat of power and actually died in prison. And if you ever want an interesting search for something, try to find that information in an encyclopedia. It's amazing, out of the 12 popes by the same name, you will frequently find like about 10 of them listed with great detail about their particular reigns and what happened during it. That pope is usually missing in most histories. They just kind of skip right over them. The second date, 1870, is marked by the fact that that was the last date of temporal power for the papacy, that in September of 1870, Victor Emmanuel took away all temporal power from the papacy. And also kind of conspicuous with 1870 is that was also earlier in that year, a number of months before, the decree of papal infallibility had been given. And along with that, the same pope had also mentioned to say that no civil power had any sovereign control over the church. Obviously, the prophecy didn't last too long. Another characteristic, we mentioned a little bit about this yesterday, is that the three beasts previous to this had had power, but were stripped of that power, but continued to live. The fourth beast, when it was to be stripped of its power, lost life at the same time. And page A260, quote, is, "It will lose dominion and life at once and go into utter destruction." And Daniel 7:12 brings that to mind, says, "And the rest, as for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and time." So we see that in their case, that was allowed to continue. However, if we go back to verse 11, we find the what happened to the fourth beast. "I beheld them because of the voice of the great words. I beheld even till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame." And this great burning flame, as we'll see, consumed all at the same time. I think Brother Rod mentioned that to us yesterday. Okay, we want to scoot now over to Daniel 2 and pick up the worldly picture of this same event. verses 31 through 45. Thou, O king, sawest and beheld a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee in the form, and the form of it was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze or brass, its legs of iron, its feet part of iron and clay. Thou sawest until a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon its feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them in pieces. Then were the iron and the clay, the brass and the silver and gold, broken into pieces, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, and no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the earth. This is the dream, and we will tell its interpretation before thee. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, a power, and strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, and the fowls of the heaven, hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee a ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. Of course, as we mentioned yesterday, we want to remember that is our scripture that gives the lease of power, not the duration, but is the authority, we might say, for the Gentile rule. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of bronze, which shall bear rule over the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of the potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it of the strength of iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not adhere one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. All right, now I think we're pretty well familiar with this development of what the various different things picture. Of course, we recognize the head, Babylon, the chest, Medo-Persia, the belly area being Greece, and finally the legs, Rome. And as we move down then into the feet and the toe picture, we pick up really the old, the Holy Roman Empire under papacy, and then ultimately we get down to the toes and we see the various different systems that would come out of that. We want to notice general characteristics here in the transition of these four different things, and we think that there was a very definite picture in picking these metals. First of all, as we go from gold, silver, brass, and iron, we find that firstly, if we take a look at the tensile strength or the malleability of these, we notice that gold, being the highest of these, happens to be the most malleable. It's the most easily shaped. It is really the softest of the metals. As we move on, we find silver is next, then last, then finally brass, and of course iron is very difficult to work with. And so we think that this would tend to illustrate the harmony of each respective system as it comes into power with God's rule or adjustment. God's rule and his laws of righteousness. So consequently, in the beginning, we see Nebuchadnezzar tried to live very closely and recognize God. And as each system came into power, the recognition of God was substantially less. Very notable here in the time that we get to the Holy Roman Empire of papacy that, that was really the worst of all of them, even though that was supposedly Christian. Nextly, we notice that in order also, starting from gold and going to iron, each one becomes less precious as a precious metal goes. And finally, when we look at the hardness of this, we recognize the rule is correspondingly hard. In other words, as each rule gets harder, or as each metal is harder as they move through, the rule was substantially harder also. Another thought we kind of looked at is when we look at the mixture of clay and iron in the toes, we notice that what is clay but imitation stone? And so consequently, we see this imitation stone or imitation kingdom is mixed in with the iron. The pastor points out the iron here is showing the civil power, therefore the clay would have to be the ecclesiastical power. And we tend to think about when you try to mix these two together, obviously they don't mix real well. But the one characteristic of clay is it is kind of tacky when it's wet. And so we recognize that when these two were originally put together with a measure of truth in the system, that they had more cohesiveness. But as time went on and the voice was no longer heard in her and the truth was removed from the system, obviously it dried out. As it dried out, it lost its cohesiveness to the point it was crumbling, even before the stone hit it. We also notice the fact of the stone hitting. It is that the stone is very common. We notice in this particular picture, all metals are sort of precious, or at least could look very impressive. Stone's common. It's right off the ground. No significance to that. No value in this picture regarded by man. And we also notice that this stone was in existence long before it hit the image, actually back to AD 33. All right, we also give you page A261, 262, and B99 to 100, both of those pointing out that each existed before it came into power. So each of the empires, just as we saw with the beasts, existed previous to coming in their power, so also with the fifth universal empire, which would clear away all the others. And this one, of course, is the one that gives the thought of the instantaneous collapse, because when the stone hit, the entire image crumbled. Okay, we have some information passed along with the point of how we arrive at our 2520 for our lease of power. And we're just going to cite references here, so you're going to have to kind of write fast. In Leviticus, the 26th chapter, we have the 17th, the 18th, the 21st, the 24th, the 26th, and the 28th verses, each dealing with punishing them seven times. And, of course, we have the seven times the 360 symbolic year, 2,520 days. In Daniel, the fourth chapter, we have the 24th, the 25th, the 28th, and the 34th verse dealing with the 7 years. Again, seven times 360 is our 2,520. And second volume, or B, 96 and 97, along with that one. Ezekiel 4, verses 4 through 6 gives us the day for the year. Numbers 14, 33 through 34, along with that. Daniel 7, verses 24 through 26, deals with the time, times, and half a time. That's our 1260. For our time from 539 to 1799. We also have in Revelation 13, verse 5, and Revelation 13, 5 is the 40 and 2 months. In Revelation 12 and 6, we go back to the 1260, represented by 1,203 score days. Also, Daniel 5, 25, 26, and 27 is the part where we find that God had numbered the kingdom and had weighed it in the balances and found it wanting. I believe Brother Rod mentioned this yesterday, but we have the Mene Mene Tekel Upharsin, which adds up to 2,020 and 500, so we have 2,520 shown in that. So we find that these things are continually repeated over and over again. We just have to hunt for them. Now, we were kind of impressed by something we ran across, because along with the 2520 being associated with the handwriting on the wall, We came across in one particular book a cartoon. And over the cartoon, this is from a 1906 German newspaper, it said, "The handwriting on the wall." And it shows a number of European monarchs attempting to pawn their crowns. And underneath was the line that said, "Objects of dubious value." So as early as 1906, they were saying that it really wasn't in one's best interest to be a king. The time of trouble was fast coming upon them, and even those in the world could see it. All right. B100. We have that this honor hath all the saints to execute the judgments written and bind their kings with chains from Psalms 149, 8 and 9. And to him that overcometh, keep my works, to him will I give power over the nations and shall rule them with a rod of iron. As vessels of a potter shall they, the empires, be broken to shivers. And that comes from Psalms 2, verses 8 and 9, and Revelation 2, 26 and 27. And we might also give you reprint 4292, column 2, and reprint 5451 along with that. So we could see this time for transition was rapidly coming upon it. One of the books we happened to find was entitled The Great Events of the 20th Century. And one of the first things we found in this was January 1st, 1900. It was giving an analysis of what the world was like at that time. So the world seemed to be a tolerably well-run place to the great men of Europe. They had peace, rising prosperity, and complex alliances. Europe was the undisputed ruler of the world. The British Empire was at its height. Five continents was dominated by the British Empire. And after all, who wanted the northern and the southern anyway, because that was just big ice flows. France had empires in Africa and Indochina. Russia was expanding into Manchuria and northern China. Germany had interests in Africa and the Pacific. So things were just as they should be. Everything was firmly in place. Now, not to think that we were exempt from all this, because it also mentions that the United States was rising in power. We still weren't a colonial power at that point, but we would emerge from the war that was to come as the strongest nation on the earth. We also found Japan was challenging Europe, primarily Russia. And the one discouraging note about all this was the working classes were getting to be a little bit militant, you know, kind of causing problems here, but it's okay, we'll take care of it. And we couldn't help thinking about Malachi 3:15 in conjunction with this. "And now we call the proud happy, yea, that work wickedness are set up, yea, that test God are even delivered." So at this particular point in time, they felt pretty comfortable. Things were going real well for them. And the world was just the way it was supposed to be. Obviously, this wasn't going to last too much longer. Now, there's a great deal of talk about something in the heavens that's coming along now. And the last time it visited us was back in 1910. In fact, in May 20th of 1910, we were to pass through the tail of Halley's Comet. And Halley's Comet has this particular interesting habit of being a traditional prophet of disaster, mostly because it was always unpredictable until more recent times. And interestingly enough, 1910 also happened to, in May, be a time that the comet seemed to fulfill its prophecy. For on May 19th, 1910, there was a line that stretched 5 miles long full of British subjects. And you kind of think, well, what is it that could attract 5 miles long of people? They were there to see and pass by the body of King Edward VII of England, who had just died. And interestingly enough, we can turn to Julius Caesar for a sort of comment along this, because, Shakespeare from the play Julius Caesar. It says, "When beggars die, there are no comets seen. The heavens themselves blaze forth the death of princes." Now we see that kind of fits somewhat in the worldly standpoint. But when one of the saints pass, greater than all the kings, nobody in the world notices. In fact, sometimes if we even find some of the brethren making it just into the obituary page in the little notice, that can almost be counted significant. On May 20th, there was a procession that took place in England for the funeral of King Edward VII. Among this procession, there were nine kings. The King of England, who was obviously dead, the King of Germany, the King of Denmark, the King of the Hellenes, the King of Norway, of Spain, Portugal, Bulgaria, and the Belgians. There were also five heir apparents: Austria, the Sultan of Turkey, the Emperor of Japan, the Tsar of Russia, and Italy. We also had 40 imperial or royal highnesses from some places as far away as like Siam, Persia, Egypt, and China. There were seven queens, and all told, royalty representing 70 nations. And in the Guns of August, it mentions that this was the greatest assembly of royalty and rank ever gathered in one place at one time. It says, and of its kind, the last. Particularly like that one. Now, Edward was kind of an interesting person, and maybe that's why this comet happened to come along at his time or whatever, but Edward was responsible for many of the alliances that led to the peace that they were so confident of in 1900. He had kind of come along with the philosophy, well, if we managed to stack each other against ourselves, no one would dare come up against each other because the awesome weight of all the allies would be too great. And so we had the Axis powers and the Allied powers. The only trouble was that it also had the opposite effect, that once activated, it wouldn't be nation against nation, but it would be all of one side against all of the other. And interestingly enough, this little postscript about this funeral said that it seemed to some observers too great a military show at a funeral of a man called the peacemaker. Going back to another source, it said there never was such a breakup. All the old buoys which have marked the channel of our lives seem to have been swept away. This was a Lord Esher, who was a friend and advisor to Edward. Now we'd like to take a look at the fourth volume, page 541. And Sister Violet and Sister Kay know exactly what's coming because this is quoted very often in our class. But this is probably one of the best single-page definitions of what was to come upon the world. "The battle of the great day of God Almighty will be the greatest revolution the world has ever seen, because it will be one in which every principle of unrighteousness will be involved. There is nothing covered that shall not be revealed." And it talks about the revealing of secret springs of political intrigue, financial policies, religious claims, etc. And finally, the bottom paragraph, which if you want to pick a paragraph to define this, says, "The battle of the great day, like every other revolutionary war, has its stages of gradual development. First, the real and fancied national and individual rights, then a keen appreciation of those wrongs by those who suffered from them." That's that troublesome masses that they were talking about, the labor problem. That lead to great controversies, wars of words, division, strifes, and opinions, and finally to revenge and strife of arms. Such is the order of the battle of the great day of God Almighty. Its general character is a struggle of light against darkness, liberty against oppression, truth against error. Its extent will be worldwide, peasant against prince, pew against pulpit, labor against capital, the oppressed of in arms against the injustice and tyranny of every kind, and the oppressors in arms for the defense of what they have long considered to be their rights when seen to be encroachments upon the rights, or even when seen to be encroachments upon the rights of others. So it all depends on which side of the question you were on as to how things were shaping up. Now, along with what was going on in England, we found that there was some additional unrest that was going on. In China, on the 12th of February in 1912, the Emperor of China abdicated, ending, interestingly enough, a 2,500-year dynasty. Soon, when the war would break out, we would find on foreign soils Chinese youths that would be educated and express the ideas of democracy, going to France, England, the United States, and Japan. In a minute, we're going to go back to that. Now, when war broke out, it was indeed terrible. And to give you some idea of the extent of that, we find that the Central Powers, excuse me, I said Axis before, that was not actually their name then, it was the Central Powers. Central Powers had four prime members: Austria-Hungary, Bulgaria, Germany, and the Ottoman Empire. And of course, our initial feud began between Austria-Hungary, a not too consequential nation, on 7/28/1914, and on the other side, we had the mighty nation of Serbia, also a major world power, also declaring war on 7/28/1914. Now, how these two little tiny nations managed to pull it off, we can only realize because of the fact that they were bound by allegiances to all these other nations. But soon we had a list pulled into this war, which we will read on the side of the Allies. We've already given the four four Central Powers, including alphabetically Belgium, Brazil, British Empire, China, Costa Rica, who managed to squeak in May of 1918, Cuba, France, Greece, Guatemala, Haiti, Honduras, Italy, Japan, Liberia, Montenegro, Nicaragua, Panama, Portugal, Romania, Russia, San Marino, Serbia, Siam, and the United States. Now, the one thing that we want to recognize about all this is, of course, while most of these were tokens and certainly had no active part in the war, the point is that if you pinpoint these on a map, you'll see that they are global in nature. And all around the world, people were pulled into this war one way or another. What we found was some inconsequential people came to Europe in support of this war. They were doing things like being busboys or waiters or a part of a labor corps or whatever that. But among these inconsequentials were some names that today we might recognize: Ho Chi Minh, Mao Zedong, and Gandhi. And all of these managed to come together at a particular point in time and actually pick up on the European ideas of democracy and freedom. And so, in essence, we see the very empires that tried to maintain themselves brought about their own destruction. Some overall totals for what was to occur in this first of the confrontations: 65 million mobilized, 8 million dead for soldiers, 20 million wounded, diseased, and mutilated, 22 million civilians, 12 million killed, and 10 million wounded. Shortly after the war, we had another 6 million die of influenza. That was an epidemic that was to cover the world and eventually claim 14 million all told. If we remember from Daniel 2, four empires were to collapse. And of course, obviously, these empires didn't any longer exist. But interestingly enough, as a result of World War II, four contemporary empires did collapse: the German, the Austro-Hungarian, the Turkish and the Ottoman, or Turkish or Ottoman Empire, and the Russian Empire. In 1912, Africa was a totally colonial continent, with two exceptions of Liberia and Ethiopia. By 1977, there were 52 more nations. And of course, we still see fragmenting and splintering going on. The war cost them $603 billion. It spawned 14 separate wars after it, great and small, both civil and revolutionary. All across Europe, people starved, and the economy was in ruins. In certain areas of Poland, people lived on roots and grass and acorns and heather. As an example of what happened to the economies, Germany in 1914 had an exchange rate of 4 marks to the dollar. By 1921, it was 14.8 marks to the dollar. By 1923, it was 62 billion marks to a dollar. Some pocket change. B-102, third paragraph, talks about the sword that would smite, but that would bring blessings in disguise. One of the comments we found says that yet at the same time, the collapse of the old order was a necessary prelude to the spread of self-rule, the liberation of the new nations and classes, the release of new freedom and independence. The old order was finally an ally of the old privilege, a fossil of the 19th century, a relic of the clockwork universe that had gone out of existence forever. Again, we point out that is not the pastor writing. That is from a contemporary history book. In fact, that's from a book titled The End of Order, which deals with the collapse of the society after World War I, and particularly dealing with the Treaty of Versailles. Another comment, an era of history had ended. Europe's old order was gone, and with it a kind of innocence that could never be reclaimed. Another one. The Great War, as we call it, stretches across time like a curtain. And this one we particularly like. Beyond it is history. This side is the world that we live in. Dimly beyond this curtain can we perceive a life which seems to break no relation to the, which seems to bear no relation to the present one, conducted apparently to a different rhythm, a different species of being, reactive to a totally different scheme of behavior. Bewhiskered monarchs wrote stiff family notes to each other before going out to shoot stag or bird. Tiaraed queens whispered behind their fans, while tight-collared and cloth-capped masses alternately rioted or cheered, forfeited the while on ale, wine, or porter at a penny a pint. So in essence, what it was saying is the masses kind of moved totally independently, and they just let them do whatever they were going to do. But that whole thing had completely passed. And of course, we recognize that wasn't just the 19th century. That was the way things had always been. Psalm 2, 8, and 9, this time we're going to read it. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the nations for thine inheritance, for the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. And of course we see this is the point at which the turnover occurs to our Lord. Now the kingdoms which had formerly had a lease were completely given to him. And it was his opportunity to smash them, clear them out of the way. And indeed they were smashed. Again from the end of order. At the end of the Great War, however, the diplomats confronted a world in fragments. A world that seemed to be in the midst of the massive psychic breakdown, of a breakdown of old combinations of states and of empires, of the disintegration of economic orders of the 19th century, of 19th century capitalism, of the eruption of sudden disaster, of riots, assassinations, of tyranny and disorder, of frivolity and despair, exhilaration and dread, on such an order of magnitude as to numb the mind. The world could easily see how tremendous this change was. The only problem is they couldn't see the cause. And only we, who are privileged to have this information at this end of the age, can see the cause behind all of this and how precious that is. It says, but far from resolving the conflicts that had begun the war had let loose even more turmoil. And of course, that was supposed to be the purpose of the war, was to decide issues. The few world rulers who dominated Versailles simply could not any longer settle the fate of the many new nations. And so we can't help thinking about here is the idea that the very small stone that was there in the inception would eventually swell and fill the entire earth. There was no way that they could hold back what was to occur. We're reminded in looking at this that the French Revolution was to be a microcosm of what was to happen here. And a number of years ago when we were looking at the fourth volume and had addressed that in the on the French Revolution, we managed to go back and find a number of different books in relation to really what the French Revolution was like. And the thing that was kind of amazing when we were reading this is the comments about the French Revolution were virtually identical to what it had done to France as to what this was talking about had happened to the entire world order. In essence, it was saying, well, yes, we got rid of a king, and now we took on a more republican form of government. And yes, we got rid of the clergy, and we now are more atheistic, or not at least as religiously oriented. And yes, we absolved ourselves of some of the debts. And yes, that the army had changed and all that. But then when it came back and made an analysis of what it was like at that point, it said, well, you know, really, other than those changes, things haven't changed much. You know, we have a bigger debt now than we had before, even though it's a different debt. And the government still is full of corruption, just like it was before, but it's a different government. And, you know, it goes on and on like that. The thought that really, while major changes had taken place, the day-to-day life was still the same. And that's the one comment we continually hear about, well, you know, things aren't that different since 1914. Look at how good they've gotten. Well, in the one sense, no, the big plague of the fact of the world having been filled with sin is still here. And we still suffer the same way, and there's still injustice. But the thing that's different is it's like the stinking body that's finally opened up, you know, and the smell is overwhelming. But at least you know what was there. Now you know the cause of death. And so we were really privileged to live in this particular time where we have a complete understanding and we can watch and we can see the development gradually. We can look at each new sort of rivulet and try to figure out how does that fit into the plan. And it's the one thing that keeps us with our eyes open to see what's going on. You know, we have to be crazy. We're the only people that probably sit there and we look at what's going on in Lebanon and rejoice. You know, everybody else is going, oh, isn't this terrible? And we say, hey, this is great. It's just old order's going. We look and see the way Israel deals with things. And we can really be strong in support of it in most of their dealings. We can look at things that are going on, all the world injustice. And we can say, yep, that's just the way it's supposed to be. And the whole time, people are going to look at us and think how crazy and insane we must be. And then really, if we consider it, the ones who are truly crazy and insane are the world. Because they are really have a reprobate mind when it comes to these type of things. We'd like to close then by considering Psalm 46 and 10. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Indeed, we have a situation. Oh, excuse me, I made a mistake. I just read the 11th verse. I knew that didn't sound quite right. I knew it sounded right. It just didn't sound like what I was looking for. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. And so we find that this command is to go forth We find that he is, in many respects, being exalted, but as yet totally unseen by the world as far as his true position. However, we do have that privilege of the 11th verse, that God is with us, and he is our source of refuge. And we can be thankful for that. And may the Lord add his blessing.
Thank you, Brother Craig. Appreciated that very much.